Well, thank you, Bruce, for taking time to speak with us today. And we're really excited to learn more about your experience and your insights as a scientist, and particularly in your field of coastal management. So to start off, the first question, could you please share with us what career achievement you're most proud of?
Thank you very much. And hopefully these reflections are of some interest, but also stimulate anyone who's listening as they reflect on their own career path and make plans going forward. And sometimes I think it's only when you've been working for some time that you can look back and make sense of where you've come from. It's not always so easy to plan deliberately ahead because circumstances change over time. Perhaps the point of departure is to say what it is I'm doing now, because what I'm doing now is a product of where I've come from and what I have been doing in the past. But my main work is now based in New Zealand at the university, Massey University in New Zealand, where I focus on coastal governance in particular, how we make choices at the coast. I focus on natural hazards planning with a particular focus on coastal hazard risk and climate change adaptation. So those three clusters of areas of work. And I'm particularly interested in how we make choices in society and in communities and how we turn intention into action in the face of change. And the term Anthropocene might be familiar to you and to people that are watching or listening. Anthropocene is the human era, and it reflects the huge impact that people have had in our cities, our towns, but across the world. And I'm particularly interested in how we might bridge science, policy, and practice. And in many ways, my career has centered on this interface between science, policy, and practice. And a lot of the work I do is centered on that. And so one of the areas of professional practice, because I've spent probably close to 12 years in working in government and running a consulting organization before going into academics, and for the last two decades have been at a university. So I've worked in the real world, if you want to put it that way, initially in South Africa. And I was privileged to lead the team that produced South Africa's white paper for coastal sustainable development, which is the policy foundation for coastal management in South Africa after the end of apartheid. And so we designed a process that created opportunity for all South Africans, including Black South Africans who had not been part of these policy processes, to have a real voice in shaping the direction of this policy. And it became the world's first Integrated Coastal Management Act. And so that was an incredible privilege to lead that process and involve people across the country in developing that policy. And to this day, that remains the foundation for how coastal management is delivered in South Africa. Since then, I've had the privilege to play a leadership role in a number of organizations over time. And one of those is as co-chair of Future Earth Coast, which previously had been LOEX, and I'd been vice chair of LOEX when Alice Newton was chair, and thereafter. And when I was asked to take on the chair role, I was very keen to have a partner and introduce the idea of co-chair. So there was one male and one female to lead SPEC, to be part of the 21st century and to share the load and to benefit from the diversity of wisdom and expertise and insight. And so I was thrilled that Val Cummins joined me as co-chair of Future Earth Coast in about, 2015, 2016, somewhere around there. And we went through this incredibly challenging time of transition from a time when LOEX had been very well funded over these long programs, first in the Netherlands and then in Germany, to a period where funding was a lot more precarious or difficult, and where we sought to build an organization with multiple universities and partners contributing to the development of what became known as Future Earth Coast. And so that's where we are now. In addition to that, in the last assessment round of the IPCC, the sixth assessment round, which is just recently completed, I was honored to play a lead role in two reports, in the Ocean and Cryosphere Report, the so-called Special Report on the Ocean and Cryosphere and a Changing Climate. I was coordinating lead author of the Sea Level Rise chapter. And then in the Working Group 2 report, which focuses on adaptation, vulnerability, and impact, I was lead author of the Climate Resilient Development Pathways chapter, the concluding chapter of the report, and also co-lead of a cross-chapter paper on cities and settlements by the sea. Detail, but those multiple roles were a tremendous opportunity to have voice in shaping the IPCC's sixth assessment. And that has been a base to open up a door. I was invited to be a lead author in a chapter of the IPBES Nexus report. IPBES is the Intergovernmental Panel on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. And the Nexus report is the interconnection of climate change, biodiversity, health, energy, water, and so on. And so I'm currently involved in that report. And then I mentioned earlier the UNESCO Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission guidance I've developed on community-based coastal hazard risk and resilience. So those have been tremendous privileges to be part of.
That's really, really impressive. So the white paper in South Africa, and thank you for sharing this history, transitioning from Lloyd's to FAC, this experience, and also this IPCC and the UNESCO community guidance. That's really, really, really impressive, Bruce. So as a scientist, what do you think that's the most, or let's say a sustainability expert, what do you think is the most enjoyable experience about your job?
Good question. And I suppose in this day and age, what we mean by scientist is something that's evolved. So as a young student, a lot of the way in which universities were organized was based around very particular disciplines. So if you were an ecologist or a geophysicist or a economist, there were particular areas within which you worked. And I was never comfortable being stuck in one disciplinary base. And so I've always been interested in working across boundaries rather than being stuck in a particular discipline. And trying to connect science, policy, and practice is another bridging endeavor. And so I've been both a practitioner and an academic. So I think of the work I do is really applied research and applied research-informed practice, and it's transdisciplinary in reach. And I'm also interested in the connection from the local to the global. So I'm intensively working with local communities to provide support to navigate the challenges faced in a time of escalating coastal hazard risk. What do you do about this if you live at the coast, especially in a low-lying coastal area, if you're a vulnerable community? There's a lot you can do at the community level, but there are also things that are beyond the influence of communities that are shaped by the political economy and global forces. And so influencing the global agenda and discourse is also important. So I work across disciplines, across science, policy, and practice, from the local to the global level, and in particular, trying to make a difference in helping people understand and address real problems, not just think about stuff that's interesting, but try and provide ways forward through the difficult circumstances that many face. And I'm particularly committed to working in ways that are enabling and empowering for more vulnerable communities, and to focus on processes that are just and equitable and promote resilience and sustainability for people and the non-human animals that we share the planet with.
Yes, indeed. And I think making a difference is always fulfilling. And as you mentioned, actually, I think science now is really driven from this curiosity-driven to solution-based science. Then we really, also at FAC, we're really promoting transdisciplinary. That's how science really meets societal needs. And so you shared a lot of your experience. In your opinion, what are some key characteristics of a successful scientist or successful practitioner towards this coastal sustainability? Yeah.
To some extent, the answer to that will depend on the organization you're working for and what its mission is, and whether you're effective in helping realize that mission. From my vantage point, and the work that I do and what I'm interested in, I'm interested in finding solutions for addressing some of the major challenges that we face, both at the local level and for humanity and the planet. And so to be effective at that means you've got to understand ways of bridging disciplinary boundaries. You've got to understand ways to bridge different knowledges. How does science connect with, relate to, and marry with local knowledge and with indigenous knowledge? You've got to understand ways to bridge the gaps between science, policy, and practice. So, you know, to become effective in work at that coalface, that interface between science, policy, and practice, you need to understand how to work across those different boundaries. You've got to be able to work independently alone, but also in teams of people from different cultural backgrounds, different language backgrounds, different knowledge backgrounds. So the ability to collaborate and deal with different points of view and different perspectives is really important. But underpinning all of that, you've got to have passion and commitment, perseverance to persist in the face of difficulty, and dedication to do that. And at the end of the day, work well with other people, even people you don't agree with, or you may not even like, because they're not easy to work with.
Exactly. These are really important traits. And actually, my next question is, in your view, what are some of the most pressing conflicts or challenges that arise at the science policy practice interface in coastal management, and how can they be effectively resolved? So I think you already answered this question, that you need to have passion, and this challenge you mentioned is at different scales, how can we bridge knowledge? So would you like to share more about these conflicts and the challenges you experienced, and is a resolution so far, you think, that's like the best strategy? Yeah.
Again, these are the big challenges that face humanity. We've crossed the threshold. We now live in a time where we live on a human-dominated planet, where global warming has taken us into a dangerous climate condition that is not something that humanity has had to live with in human history, and it's going to get worse. And so very, very challenging time, and it's very easy to become despairing and lose hope, because the threats are very real to people and to the planet, and it's not evenly distributed. There's some people and there's some parts of the world that face much more critical threats than others, including low-lying islands that are literally being inundated and will be gone in coming decades. And so if we're going to really make sense of these challenges, I think we have to overcome a number of failures. One is we've got to find new ways to reconcile the interests that we have in the short and the long term. This is about current and future generations. If we're going to rob future generations of resources, of safety and of prospects, and we're going to rob non-human species of a healthy planet, then we're going to fulfill our short-term needs, but we're going to destroy the planet and ourselves in the process. So finding a way to reconcile short and long-term needs is absolutely critical. A second aspect that's crucial is we have to reconcile private interest and public interest. Our own personal interest is situated in the context of our species being a social species. We're a communal species. We depend on each other. And even though what's happening in Ukraine right now, what's happening in various geopolitical debates suggests that somehow we could exist independent of each other, and that's just simply not true. So how we learn to honor and respect each other and meet our private needs while reconciling those interests, individual needs with wider communal and societal needs is really important. The third element is the relationship between the local and the global. We are connected. We need to think globally, act locally, that old saying, but it's very real because there are global conditions and circumstances largely centered in the political economy, the distribution of wealth and power, that make local reality extraordinarily difficult for people who are poor and marginalized. So we've got to find new ways of confronting poverty, injustice, inequity, and so on. And that's at the heart of recalibrating the way we connect the local and the global. And lastly, the fourth point I'd make is that we've got to reconnect with the reality that we are dependent on a healthy planet. We depend on the well-being of nature. We're not above nature, we're part of nature. And that's an incredibly arrogant perspective that the West in particular has fostered in the last few hundred years that we've got to work around. And that means we've got to confront greed and the insatiable appetite to consume and to destroy that compounds inequity and injustice, all of which is centered at the coast because people are concentrated along the seashores of the world. That's where people want to be. That's where incredible beauty, resource, assets are. And a lot of the coastal conflict is a product of those features that we've got to confront. So those, you know, this at the end of the day, the answer to your question might be a bit surprising, but it has to do with values and ethics. And we have to recalibrate the way we think about who we are and what we do.
It's really the question for everyone. It's really inspiring, Bruce. So those 4 points you mentioned, this long-term perspective, and we need to align private and public interest, and we need to think globally and act locally. I really like this. And we also need to recalibrate the dependence on nature. So could you share a specific example of a coastal community or a region where you witnessed this positive impact after your work or during your work at the Science Policy and Practice Interface in building resilience and sustainability?
It would be fantastic if we could light up a global map of all the successful community-based endeavors, because there would be many lights. The trouble is that the cumulative effect of consumerism and materialism and excess has meant that globally we have unraveled the health of many of the ecosystems and life support systems we depend on. And so there are far more bad examples and disappointments and failures than there are examples that endure of good practice. But there are many, many communities doing good work literally around the world. The challenge is to sustain those good practices and for them to persist in the face of those wider processes that are driven by dependence on fossil fuels, the desire to consume and be individually wealthy at the expense of equity and justice. So I don't want to leave a note of despair, but I know that, and I've worked with communities in South Africa, in Brazil, in New Zealand, and elsewhere, where people are making a real difference and they are making progress. I have hope in young people, individuals like Greta Thunberg. You know, these are individuals making a global difference, but it requires us to work collaboratively and find ways to overcome the dark side of humanity. So the last example I would give you is the transition from apartheid to democracy in South Africa. And that's a long time ago, and there's a lot that needs to be improved. There's still deep poverty and inequity and greed and so on in South Africa. But the period after the end of apartheid was a very profoundly encouraging and positive space to be, because people were really working hard together to reconstitute a place that was a better place than where it had been. And so the white paper and the coastal policy and the subsequent act that we produced, it was an incredible privilege to work with so many people determined to make a real difference, who put the public ahead of the private, who focused on the long term over the short term, who were mindful of the importance of the coastal ecosystems and other species we share. And so for me, that's a really good example of a time when there was a very positive energy to work collaboratively, respecting difference and finding ways to move forward.
Right. Thank you. It's really inspiring to hear about such positive outcomes, and we have so many good practices. And given your experience, which role do you see Future Earth Coast playing in addressing the governance and sustainability challenges faced by coastal communities globally?
So I've always thought that Future Earth Coast has got has had and can even build a more strong role and influence in bringing people together. And in this context, it's bringing people together who are seeking to better understand our coastal systems and ways to better manage these ecosystems and these systems that we depend on and that we enjoy so much. So we've done a brilliant job at bringing coastal scientists together, and the recent work done to bring young researchers across regions together is fantastic. Because it's only by bringing together people from different backgrounds, different points of view, different knowledges, that we can begin to think through and address the challenges of the Anthropocene, what lies ahead. I think that what we can do even better is to connect more strongly coastal science, coastal research, and practice. And I think that there's quite a lot of work that we can do to strengthen Future Earth Coast at a regional scale, so that we have regionally strong activities that network researchers and policymakers and practitioners and local communities together. So that's, for me, the most powerful role that Future Earth Coast can play, and a particular focus on creative ways to communicate and get that message out about the importance of a just and sustainable future for the coast.
Thank you so much. This is really insightful. All points taken. And indeed, I think our collaborative approach is really like vital in tackling global challenges. Yeah. And okay, now on a lighter note. So if you were not a scientist and not a practitioner, what other profession would you have chosen?
So I've had the privilege of working in the university context as an academic, but I've also been a government official working in a ministry for the environment in South Africa, focused on the coast. in a regulatory role, a lawmaking and decision-making role. And I've also run a consulting organization where we worked in post-apartheid South Africa in the public realm, providing advice and support to in the public arena, typically in processes like that coastal policy that I mentioned. Now I'm in the role primarily as a social scientist, doing critical social science work. And by critical social science, I mean my interests are not just at the superficial level of what is going on in society. I'm interested in what are the root causes and drivers of unsustainable, unjust, and inequitable processes, and to address the structural causes of those problems. And so that informs how to bridge science, policy, and practice, the local and global. And really, that's my my interest. And I've been able to do that work in government to a limited degree, in private consulting to a limited degree, and in academia to a limited degree. Each of those different domains has positive and negative about the impact that you can have. So in government, you actually make real decisions and you have to put up bureaucracy and all of the sorts of constraints. In private consulting, you provide advice, but you never make the decision and you never have time to think about or to learn and to refresh yourself. You're just chasing one project after the other. And in academia, you have the privilege of time to focus on something. And again, you're not making decisions. So in terms of profession, I think you need to find yourself in many different places to understand what works best for you. And I love what I do now as an academic, because I'm working with local communities in a very applied action research.
I have to say, actually, your reply would be you wouldn't have chosen anything else, because in your career path, you experienced all professions and you played different roles, from pure academia to check root cause, then to consultancy, then to decision-making board. So you have witnessed and experienced the whole flow of this and how us as a human race to work together towards sustainability. It's really impressive. Like, you've been doing what you hoped to do and you made it. Mm-hmm. So we also would like to know more about your interests outside of your work. Like, what would you do in spare time?
So as many academics that are have been around for a while, there is no such thing spare time. My work consumes my life, so I spend most of my time working, which is on one level sad, but it's also very positive because I love what I do and it's making a difference. But when I do stop working, I like to be in the outdoors, which I don't do enough of, but I love to be in the mountains and at the coast, hiking, sailing, and anything in the outdoors. And yeah, I also enjoy photography, doing landscape photography and wildlife photography, music, guitar, family, friends. Those are the things that I enjoy. And traveling to places that are, you know, the planet is a place of incredible grandeur and beauty. And so traveling to those places is something important.
It's really wonderful. And I think actually you have the privilege when you work in your and to see different places and to experience different local communities. It's really awesome. And finally, what advice would you give to young scientists starting their careers?
Yeah, I think choosing a direction of study should be a choice informed by where your heart wants you to be. As hard as that might seem, it's very tempting, and often parents are very influential to choose a job, career, or an educational pathway because of job prospects. And that is typically not necessarily the wisest decision anymore. What is more important, I think, is to choose an educational foundation that enables you to be a critical, independent thinker. If you choose the very technical course of study, it gives you a bunch of technical skills, but it doesn't necessarily enable you to be independently critical in your thinking. And if you want to make a difference in this world, technical, rational solutions and ways of thinking are simply not adequate. We need out-of-the-box, creative, innovative thinking, and that comes with critical social science and interdisciplinary ways of thinking. And so my advice to young people starting their careers, choose an education pathway that's going to enable you to think critically, and then invest in your education. You know, it's very tempting to want to start to earn a salary when it may be better to invest further in furthering your education. That is the most wise investment you can make. So beyond that, be open to outcomes that you may not expect to deliver the best way forward. In other words, working for government may not be something that you think is a good idea, but until you've done that, you've worked in the private sector, until you've worked in a university setting, how do you know what is the best pathway? So I think you need to experience the world, travel, invest in your education, and follow your heart.
I love this advice, really. And thank you so much for sharing these valuable insights and advice with us. So one last question. So what kind of support and resources are willing to offer to help FAC fellows? You know, you're a FAC academician. So what kind of resources? And how do you encourage them?
Well, I think you're creating the opportunities for webinars and for interactions. There may be training opportunities, interactive opportunities, and I'm keen to contribute through the forum that you create for those kind of opportunities. I've mentioned in our earlier conversation, we're speaking about the Just Transitions work and the webinar series. I'm keen to share some reflections, particularly centered in this UNESCO work that I've shared with you earlier. And I think creating a space for that kind of dialogue is probably the most practical and constructive way of contributing.
Indeed. And I think that's really, as an early career researcher myself, and I really think that's what you will really need. Yeah. Thank you very much. It's so generous of you. And we really appreciate your willingness to support young researchers. And thank you again for your time and your participation in this interview. It has been a great pleasure to speaking with you.